This episode is brought to you by the American Urological Association.
Good evening. My name is Jay Rahman, and I'm professor of urology and chair of the AUA's Office of Education. It's my pleasure to host another episode in our educational podcast series with this specific show titled Principles of Clinical Practice, Journal Club 101. It's my real distinct pleasure to have Dr. Melissa Kaufman as our guest. I could pretty much spend about 30 minutes going through all of Dr. Kaufman's accolades, but to sort of summarize maybe in about 1 minute, she is professor of urology at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center. She's a Patricia and Rhodes Heart Endowed Chair. She's a chief of the Division of Reconstructive Urology. She has a long history of supporting the AUA, which we are very grateful for, whether it be Practice Guidelines Committee, Core Curriculum, and the Medical Student Urological Committee. She's currently the Guidelines Panel Chair for Genitourinary Syndrome of Menopause. And she's also has an extensive history of being an associate editor for the Journal of Urology and for Neurourology and Neurodynamics. And in that regard, I think she has a unique amount of expertise in covering the domain today, which is really just talking about Journal Club Review 101, really the concept of peer review and what we should be thinking about when we review articles and manuscripts. So first off, Melissa, really, thank you so much for carving some time out. Really, our pleasure and my delight to be able to host you today.
It's really actually my honor to be able to do this and to give some more outreach and insights into the value of what we're doing from the regards of peer review for all of our membership. So thanks for this opportunity.
So, you know, I think that these are always helpful before we sort of dive into some of the nuances and the specifics of peer review and practices, to really take a step back and maybe just give us a sense of the history of peer review and you know, how what are the broad principles? Where did this start? And then I feel like it's a little easier to talk about some more of the details pertaining to the review process itself. So walk us through maybe the history a little bit.
Oh, I love that question because it's oftentimes one that is just become such an occult situation in many instances that people don't know why we do this and where it came from. You think you have an idea of exactly what's happening with regards to peer review, but it's a very, very interesting history. And one of the basic tenets of peer review is, you know, it's fundamental to our process of developing and publishing evidence-based data for us to move science forward. You know, this is an incredible privilege, but it's also an extraordinary responsibility. And it's one that I deeply believe everyone who is engaged in clinical practice should become involved with. And it's become so completely integrated and essential for us to validate all of our medical literature. But the process actually dates back to Syria in 900 AD. There was a group that was vetting the practice of one of their colleagues and determining whether, in fact, what they were doing was what we would consider today to be called standard of care. It was really centuries until that process was aimed at improving manuscripts. You know, as early back as in the Spanish Inquisition, there was a Spanish physician, Servetus, this was 1553, and he had suggested that blood passed from the right side of the heart to the left side of the heart through the lungs. And John Calvin had him burned at the stake for this, right? So this was fueled by innovation of the scientific method that was then pioneered by Francis Bacon and the Royal Society of London. They had a manuscript, a journal called Philosophical Transactions. So it was really Francis Bacon that adopted the process of inspecting a submission by using a select group of knowledgeable members. And that was truly the dawn of what we would consider contemporary peer review. And so this brought in the age of scientific method. But what's really shocking about that, this was the 1800s, right? What's really shocking about that is some of the journals that we consider top tier, things like the Journal of the American Medical Association, the journal Science. It wasn't until the 1940s that they adopted peer review. In a journal like The Lancet, it was 1976. 1976 that they adopted peer review. Until that time, it was actually just a system where the editor of the journal would review each manuscript and adjudicate it based on that. So our current system, then the one that our authors anticipate, is for a fair and unbiased critique. And it's one where we want people to improve their manuscript. So it's important for those who are endeavoring into writing manuscripts to become involved in this, for those who are endeavoring even to evaluate literature for utilization for their own patient population to become involved. But what is truly, truly shocking is that in urology, and in fact in most disciplines, there is very little integration of peer review process in a formal curriculum for urologists or for any trainees for that matter. So that's
Yeah,
why
I mean,
this
I think
opportunity, yeah.
that perspective is so valuable because, I think we often think about peer review being something that is so central just to academic physicians. And I think one of the points you made, which is anybody that is involved in clinical practice, this is part of, I think, what you should be doing and thinking as you just think about the data, the literature, and then how you care for your patients. And so I do think that the hope is, programs like this help really disseminate the idea of and the value of peer review as opposed to it being sort of catered to a small population of perhaps academics in the field.
And I think some of it has been hidden, somewhat occult, as I mentioned before, because we don't get schooled during our residency and what this process actually is. And there's lots of models of how people have done peer review. And I think that that also is a detractor for some individuals, is that no one really knows exactly what happens. It still remains a little bit of a black box when people will submit manuscripts or they look at the literature and they say, how did this end up being published? And we have several models, and one of them is, a single blind model. And this is one that we used to use in a for many, many decades, where the authors are known to the reviewer, but the reviewer has no idea who's actually, the authors are known to the reviewer, but not vice versa. So the authors can't tell who's reviewing their manuscript. And in double blind reviews, and there are a number of journals where this occurs, neither the authors or the reviewers are identified to each other. Now, the most transparent option is called an open review. And this is where both authors and reviewers are known to each other. So it was a few years ago that we actually began to initiate something similar to open review at the Journal of Urology. And it promotes, I think, transparency, but you can also have anonymity in situations. If you are in a, we're in a very, very small field. So if there is a situation where this is just for manuscripts that go to publication, but if there's a situation where you choose to remain anonymous, then it's completely appropriate and that's respected. But it also gives, it begins to open up these doors so there is transparency so we can have open conversations because, again, it's not about critiquing someone's manuscript. It's about allowing the science to improve, to go and become published and then become part of how we interact with patients every day.
So, can you give us a little bit of a sense? And I don't know if you know this, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but you outlined sort of different models of review. Do you get a sense of where most journals are? Where is the majority, or are they spread across that entire spectrum across the board?
Yeah, most journals are single blind, and so the authors are known to the reviewer, but not vice versa. And so that ends up being quite a difficult situation when you've got smaller fields, and you have then the opportunity for, as you can imagine, bias. because that's the other issue that comes in. This is, remains a human endeavor. And so you have bias, you have conflict of interest, but you can also have overt fraud, right? And unfortunately, like now we're in an age of electronic submissions. We're in an age of artificial intelligence. There's ample opportunity in this setting to really defraud the peer review process. And there's actually been several high profile schemes where impersonation of reviewers has been uncovered. And there have been security changes and editorial systems secondary to this, you know, but there's also fraud that's not so overt. So breaching confidentiality, plagiarizing, stealing ideas, or even holding a manuscript hostage while your competing publication moves forward. Like, these are real, real human endeavors, and those things can occur. And so as a peer reviewer, it's an honor to be at the forefront of the concepts in your area of expertise, but we have to do it as part of an integrity to not abuse that privilege, to keep the system one of integrity. And so those are very difficult conversations. The other conversation that we've been having more and more, certainly in the Journal of Urology, is the importance of diversity and peer review, because that is critical to our scientific literature, and it just can't be overstated. And it's not just the reviewers, but this then that parlays into authorship, but to have and embrace a variety of perspectives and backgrounds and experiences gives more insight, gives a more comprehensive and well-rounded assessment of the submitted papers.
So you talked a little bit, you know, about the don'ts, you know, as you went through that sort of list of things. And, you know, I could say to myself, exactly as you were going through, I think are many of the concerns that exist out there, whether it's bias, whether it's conflict, whether it's the intentions of the reviewer. But let's look at it maybe the other side of it, which is what should be some general review practices. So we've talked about what not to do, but maybe for those that are really wanting to engage in this process, maybe let's just start off with just general review practices, maybe best practices from someone like yourself, who obviously is spent a lot of time at the editorial board level at different journals.
Yeah, thank you so much for that question. I want to encourage anyone who is in a position of performing manuscript reviews right now, or in a position of leadership with residents or with mentoring any other urologist, to take this opportunity and help others become engaged in peer review. I was so fortunate to have Dr. J. Smith, former editor, as my chairman, and he really set forth some ideals about expanding not just my own urologic knowledge, but ensuring accuracy of all our published materials, and that authors anticipate and deserve fair and unbiased critiques. And that's what your job is as a manuscript reviewer. It's to correct any faults, but the idea that this is going to be published, because nowadays it's going to be published somewhere for certain. It may not be in an AUA journal, but it's likely to end up being published somewhere. Mm-hmm. So the first thing is understanding what the limits of your own peer expertise are. Right. If you get a manuscript, and it happens not terribly infrequently, that's a little bit outside where your comfort zone of being able to have knowledge of the contemporary literature, or that you feel is outside what you would be considered an expert peer in, then just let the asking editor know. That's your own, you know, reality check. Make sure you have time to do the review. That's just a fundamental issue. I have a colleague, Beth Mueller at Loyola, who told me a long time ago that if she gets a manuscript to review and she can't do it in X period of time, like she looks at her schedule and says, I know that during the next week of time, I will not have the bandwidth to do this, then she declined, whether she was interested in reading the manuscript or not. And that's not, so you're not disingenuous, because that becomes a bigger burden as the authors then have to wait longer and longer for more outreach, for more peer review. Remember, your central goal is improving the manuscript so you can impact patient care. And you always do like a first pass read. And you can sometimes pick up, if there's some difficulties with language and grammar, that's expected. We're an international society now. You know, the AUA is an international organization. So we welcome and we want manuscripts sometimes from non-native English speakers. So give them some latitude and know that a lot of those things can be fixed on the back end. You're looking for the science. You're looking for a 30,000 foot view to start. Like, what is the design of the study? Is there something that you need to understand? What's the hypothesis and what are the general findings? After you've done that 30,000 foot view, then really dive into the granular aspects. So the best ways to do this, and I see a little bit of both, is either review each section and give commentary, say on the introduction, commentary on the materials and methods. But whatever you do, it's so helpful to the authors to be able to make comments by bullet points so they can keep track of what's happening. The other thing that Dr. Susskind, who's also an associate editor, taught me was to review the figures and tables early in the process. Don't read the manuscript and then wait to look at the figures and tables. She often told me that she goes to those first, right? Because it gives you a lot of insight into how it's going to be interpreted later. But overall, you can, look for, does this data really support the hypothesis? What does the study add to the literature? And when you give your recommendations, you can, even if you know the authors and you know the validity of the work that they've published in the past, it doesn't mean that they automatically get a pass just because of that. So be honest. And there is opportunity when you make comments to the editor regarding the manuscript, it is confidential. If you honestly believe that this is not going to pass muster and should not be part of our literature, at least in the form that it was sent in, then please be honest about that. And I find that it's very, very difficult in many instances to reject manuscripts from, leading authors in a field. But trust me, they're more used to it than anyone else. They've been rejected more than anyone else, and that's why they're leaders in their field, because they're constantly striving to get that information back so they can improve their manuscripts.
I think so many of your points here are really important. I think of a few things. I think number one, perhaps the most frustrated I get sometimes as an author, and at this point as a senior author, is submitting a manuscript, and whatever the verdict might be, but especially if it's a rejection, not having formative comments to improve the manuscript. And I would rather have a bullet point of the flaws in the study, the flaws in the methodology, maybe areas where the results were not framed correctly based upon the data being shown. Maybe the conclusions were maybe not wrong, but different. But I think that feedback, getting back to your points that you've made repeatedly, it may not be in the AUA journal, it may not be in the Net European Urology, it may not be in BJU, so on and so forth. But this work will find, in the era that we live in, it will find a home somewhere. And I feel like the better critique that we get, that final product, wherever it ends up, is going to be, I think, a better contribution to the literature. Is that sort of a fair statement?
I believe that, and absolutely. And we are ever iterating the process to improve transparency for the authors so they know exactly where everything is during the peer review process, and also decrease the burden for their reviewers. And ultimately, it's an evidence base that will benefit our patients. They're the ones who rely most heavily on this peer review process. And because it has been so mysterious, the Journal of Urology, the American Urological Association, have really embarked on developing a lot of resources for training of peer reviewers and creating an environment that values and promotes these initiatives. This podcast is just one example of that. But we actually, Dr. George Koch has developed a primer on peer review that is available on the AUA site, as well as we have a core curriculum offering with myself, Dr. Krauss, and Dr. Ginsberg called Journal Club 101 and Manuscript Best Practices. But what I encourage you to do is ask a colleague that you know participates in this. Reach out to me, reach out to the journal editor, reach out to Dr. Siemens. Say, I'm interested in participating, I'm interested in learning. You will find lots of mentorship that is available because this is such a critical aspect of who we are as scientists, as clinicians, and it is so completely relevant to every aspect of our patient care and for their experience. We have this unprecedented opportunity, and we have to have personal accountability to propel urology forward.
So I'll tell you how I look at a paper, and then maybe I'm going to ask you. You talked about what Dr. Suskind does. I'm going to ask you maybe your specific approach, understanding that everyone is different. But I'll tell you what I do. I read the abstract, I read the introduction, so I sort of have a sense of where is this person coming from and where are they going? What is there, to your point, what is the contribution to the literature? I then go look at the tables and the figures because I want to get a sense of what am I going to see, where is this going, and then I go through the methods and the results to see whether the results that I'm reading about match up with perhaps the figures and the tables that I've sort of looked at, but obviously then look at more closely now that I know what's coming. And then obviously the discussion is often, at least for me, the last part I get to. And to me, it's the part which is important, but I care more about, to be honest, the science. And then the discussion is how does this kind of fold into everything? But I could live with, at least on first pass, maybe a discussion that needs to be tightened up. If the science is really good, maybe it's just how to contextualize the work. Maybe give us a sense, what is the Kaufman strategy? And understand that maybe the Kaufman strategy is different than the Raman strategy, which is different than the Suskind, so on and so forth.
Yeah, my beginning is always that 30,000 foot view. I'm questioning whether this has major issues with the design. I'm really wanting to make sure that the title and the hypothesis match their the end conclusions, right? So it's a very, very broad swath of looking at the validity of the manuscript as a whole. And then topically, like, did the authors, when you go to the introduction, did they explain the background? Did they build an argument for why the study needed to be done? Did they use appropriate references? And sometimes, if you're an expert in the field, you know that they have either omitted a reference that should have been included because it's part of that contemporary literature. And did they really tell me what was the gap? What's the rationale that prompted this study? And did they design the study so the aims and objectives actually match that? I dive then into, I do look at the figures, I do look at the data, the tables, but then I dive into the methods. How did well did they describe their methods? Were the techniques well described? Can I follow it? Could I replicate it? Can I reproduce this study? What was their true primary outcome? Did they use validated instruments? Did they have IRB approval? And one of the issues that we're running into more and more as we have much more sophisticated analysis is, did they use the appropriate statistics? And I find this is a large barrier for a lot of urologists, is that we don't know. I'm not a biostatistician. Fortunately, we have biostatisticians and a statistical board at the journal that allows us to actually send these manuscripts that are going towards publication and have an appropriate statistical review. So I'm not the one to decide whether they had an appropriate power and sample size calculation. So we often will request statistical evaluation, and that really has changed the face of the information that we're putting out in the journal. It manifestly improves those manuscripts tremendously. Then I'm looking at their results. Are they straightforward? I check numbers. I make sure that the numbers add up. I make sure that they are not commenting on the data during the results. They're just presenting the data. And do the figures and the graphs that I reviewed, do they actually help support the data, or are they just accessory? We all love beautiful pictures, right? We love to look at pictures. We're surgeons and we're three-dimensional and we're visual learners, but sometimes they're just unnecessary, right? They don't support the data and they're not doing much to enhance that. And is this matching up with the abstract? And then in the discussion, I want people to make their argument. I want their outcomes for them to explain to me why their outcomes fit their hypothesis, how it fits the literature, how it affects care, or how it affects future research. Why the most important, one of the most important things too, is that they acknowledge that there are strengths in the study and what those are, and that there are limitations to the way they've performed their study and what those are. And to justify and address these is very critical, because we address them when we're going through as a manuscript reviewer, but to see that the authors accept those limitations and have accommodated for that really makes a strong stance for the argument. And then it's very difficult for me to go back and point out a limitation that they've already pointed out for themselves. But give me a good take-home message in the conclusion, and did you answer the study's objectives? So in general, that's how I go through and look at each aspect of a manuscript. And again, making sure that all the appropriate references, if I'm truly an expert in that topic, I should have a fairly robust idea of what some of them ought to be. And you can always go back and look as well. Like, I do spend time in PubMed searching literature when I'm reviewing a manuscript to make sure that I have a full background of what may be contemporary and what way may we may need to weigh in on this particular data set.
The concept of commentary, when we get to the end of a lot of these, you give your review, and almost every journal will say, do you think that this article would benefit from a commentary? Would you be willing to write a commentary? What are your thoughts on that? When should the answer be? I mean, the answer can't always be yes, but when is a commentary valuable? What's your sort of advice for the reviewers on this concept of the commentary after the article, and offering your ability to write that commentary?
No one knows that data and the general scope of how it fits into the literature and how it's going to move science forward better than you at that moment after you've reviewed the manuscript. So if you believe that this is a manuscript that will be widely utilized, widely referenced, that it's going to impact our science, impact our patient care, impact our capacity to move this discipline forward, then I strongly encourage you to check the box. And you will get the outreach from Dr. Siemens. You will get the outreach from Dr. Cameron or Dr. Wien to then write commentary. And it allows you to basically take your review. It's actually, you've already done all the work, because you've written out your entire review, and allows you to put that in the context and make a story that is compelling for the readership. Because frankly, sometimes the readership doesn't get much further than the conclusions of the abstract. But to put that into context, to have your commentary to allow people to see how this can parlay into improving whatever the particular situation is for our patients is really a critical task. And it's also one that allows you to become even further respected in the your field because you were tapped to for that task. So it's a nice accolade in addition to a valuable resource for the readership.
That's great. No, I appreciate you making mention of that and answering that question. Melissa, any final thoughts that you'd like our listeners to go home with today?
So again, this is review, manuscript review is an incredible opportunity, and it is concomitantly a really profound responsibility. And we all must participate in the process and really strive to enhance our evidence base, because ultimately, as I've mentioned, it's our patients that rely on us to accomplish this peer review and move the field forward.
Melissa, always always delightful to talk with you. I'm very appreciative that you took 30 minutes out of what is seemingly always going to be a busy day for you. I think the way you are passionate about the art of review is truly inspiring, and do very much appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Dr. Roman, and thank you to the AUA for hosting these podcasts and allowing us to disseminate our passion.
To our reviewers, or you got me so much on the reviewer realm now, I'm talking about reviewers. To our audience, thank you very much for your time and your attention. We will have attached to this podcast some of the references that Dr. Kaufman mentioned, including the core curriculum link, as well as the primer on peer review from Dr. George Koch. And Melissa, I look forward to seeing you in a few weeks, as well as many of our other membership in San Antonio.
Thank you.